Blog Talk Radio.
Behind the Blue Curtain, Saturdays at 11 a.m. Eastern.
Expression despised.
All right. Good morning, everybody. Welcome. Welcome to Behind the Blue Curtain. I'm your host, Stan Mason. Glad everybody's here. Everybody made it through the week. Everybody on here is cold, except for the chief. He'll brag about it later. But everybody on here is cold. It's about to get real cold. It's cold down here in Atlanta. Anyway, heck of a week. Glad everybody made it through. Glad everybody is here. And we're gonna kick everything off. John, you got a special announcement. There's something that we're going to do that no other show has done, at least that I know of, that we're going to do here. So I'm going to let you go last, but we're going to go around and say good morning, and we're going to go up to the woman in red up there, the red screen. Claire, good morning. How are you?
Hello. Good morning, everybody. It's been just a hectic week for me. I'm just ready to get the show on the road. I'm ready to get going. Happy to be here.
All right. We're glad to have you back. Dr. Behavior, how are you?
I'm wonderful. How's everybody doing?
Good, good. All right, let's drop over. Izzy, what's going on? How was your week? I see the hat.
I'm cold, but otherwise good. Happy to be here. Ready to get started with this Why You Mad episode.
There you go. Why you mad? Why you hate? Chief. How was your week, brother? What's going on?
My week sucked. That's because I'm angry. No. it's been a challenging couple of weeks, but, you know, all good. I know we talked about temperature, -1, -20. It'll be 65 here, I think, today in Texas. So I'm excited about that. I'm less angry about that than everything else. So, but ready to start on this topic. Going to be an interesting show.
And, brother, to your credit, I'm going to give you some acknowledgement because, I mean, you're managing a police department in a COVID environment with all kind of people out every day for a long time, and you're fighting through it. So I'm going to give you a big what's up. And a lot of people I don't think they realize that cops do get sick. And you know, we're not superhuman people, and when we're gone, that's maybe why your calls can't get handled, and you can't call in somebody because people you want to call in are sick, too. So, you know, that's got to be hard on you juggling that, brother, but, you know, I'm sure the people in Hewitt appreciate you.
It's like I said, it's been a challenge. We're not as hard hit as a lot of places. I mean, these agencies that have hundreds and thousands of employees. I know they're feeling the strain of it as well. But, you know, when you've only got so many people to go around, there's others that got to pick up the slack and go answer those calls. So, but anyway, we're here. We're getting a little bit of relief. And so ready to roll.
There you go. Let me drop up. Big Joe, what's going on, brother? How's your week up there in Chi? I know y'all cold.
Please. Let me just say this. As my guy in the movie said, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. So there. So let's kick this off with a bang.
I'm going to drop down to the man of the hour. And I started doing the thing on my Facebook to where, you know, every couple of days I'll put somebody's picture up as my Facebook picture because these are people, you know, even my Facebook shouldn't be all about the stand thing. And these are people who y'all see me, but there are a lot of people behind me that make me every day. It ain't all about me. And I had to pick this brother. Just, and y'all can go to my page and read it. I'm not going to go down through all of it. But when you talk about someone who comes back from the bottom of the backside of beyond and then contributes beyond those who never been where he's been, you know, I mean, and I'm going to leave that picture up actually for a couple more days because I think it's appropriate. And he came up with a magnificent idea for this show. because, like I said, this is our show. This is not Stan's thing. This is our show. And he came up with something that was phenomenal, and I'm going to let him introduce himself and tell y'all about that idea. What's up, Big John?
I don't know, man. I feel like The Undertaker from the WWE, man. Like, I sat up come out of the grave after that introduction. Izzy just reminded me how cold it is with his hat, so I might have to hit the heater again. As Stan said, and I'm going to take it a little step further. This is not our show. It's the people's show.
Mm-hmm.
And we try to, here at Behind the Blue Curtain, is to reach the audience and the needs of the people. And when we talk about police reform, it's not because Stan has an axe to grind or Jim or Joe or Claire. When we talk about mental health, Dr. Corsi doesn't have an axe to grind. Izzy don't have beef with everybody in media. It's for the people. We here for the people, and I'm not bitter against the prison system. So with that being said, the thought is that what we want to do is make this next up-and-coming show about the people. So we're going to ask everyone to send a topic to Stan, and whoever gets the most likes, we will do that topic next week. And they will sit in as a co-host. Actually, they will be leading the show.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the idea, is to engage our audience. And no other show is doing that but us. And we're for the people, not for ourselves. This is why this is not the Stan and Family show. This is not the Stan Mason mm-hmm. and Company show.
Yeah.
This is Behind the Blue Curtain. But had it been Joe, it would have been the Joe and the Joette.
And you know, John, this show was actually named that way. When I was looking for a title for the show, I actually let the people in Waco name this show. You know, and that's how we did. And what I want to do is for this show broadcast, you guys be thinking right now, if there's a topic you want to talk about, it's important to you, you think we've missed it, we've overlooked it, no one's talking about it, put it in the comments, and then what we'll do is we'll go to about Tuesday. And then Tuesday evening, we'll look at the ones with the most likes, the top five with the most likes, and we'll put those in a separate post for you guys to vote on by likes and clicks, and we'll run that till Thursday. Thursday evening, we're going to announce whoever won that show, and as John said, now if you put up a topic that's important to you and you get the most likes, you know, I'm going to contact you, reach out, bring you on with everybody. We'll conference call and talk. You're going to host that show. That is going to be your show, not Stan's show or the Chief or Joe or Izzy or Dr. B.A. It's your show. You're going to do it. And we'll support you and what you're doing. So this is your chance. When we say it's your show, it is. It's your show. And this is the chance to bring it up. And so if it's important to you, it's important to us. And with that, we're going to get into this week's topic. What is wrong with everybody? Anger over everything. I mean, there is, you can see more anger videos now online than you can kindness videos. And people are angry over nothing. That's the topic we're going into. Good morning, Facebook. You guys are welcome to chime in. If you want to call in, 646-716-4621, we'll bring you on. And let's get into anger. And I'm going to, whoever wants to kick this one off, feel free.
Well, I think it's fitting that the doctor of behavior.
Absolutely.
I should.
I'm not kidding. I'm going to dump out there. Anger, everybody's mad. All right? Everybody's mad. We have several small schools in our area. And school boards are discussing shutting down spectators at basketball games because we're having fights from the spectators. And then the kids are getting involved. And then the kids are getting charged. And we're having craziness happen in the stores. And people are, you know, we had the fight over toilet paper not so long ago. We have all of these things going on, right? So So there's a whole bunch, and I'll break it down. We'll break it down in little chunks as we go through, because it's not like my show or anything. But what I'll say about anger is that anger is considered a primary emotion with secondary response. So what that means is you feel something else before you display or feel anger, or before you choose anger. Because anger is a choice. Just like you could take some deep breaths, you could walk away, you could blow up, right? That's an option. It's fast, so people will fight me and say, no, I feel anger first. No, you feel something else unpleasant first. In today's society, we have kind of coined unofficially a new title called Angry, which is pandemic angry. And what we're seeing is the stress of the changes that we've all been forced to undertake are rising up, and it's people are blowing their top. So we'll chat kind of where that anger comes from and how the brain functions and where it comes from. I love to teach people that, because somehow when I get mad, my brain will go to one of those like little facts, right? Like, I'll notice something in somebody that's mad, and I'll be like, I bet they're feeling scared right now. I wonder if they're, right? So in short, anger happens because we have reactions in our body and our brain that make us uncomfortable, and we don't have social skills and coping skills to be able to use words to tell people how we feel, and so we will display it in acts of aggression because somehow in our society that makes us bigger and badder and stronger than everyone else. And I would argue that that is, we'll continue to chat about that.
I have a question for you, doctor.
Sure.
How long does anger last? Because I know that Jim, Joe, Claire, Stan would probably tell us from a, you know, when you're dealing with, let's say like crime, someone comes home, they find a significant other in bed with someone else, and they choose anger, right? That anger only lasts this long. How long does anger last?
So here's the way I'll kind of describe the anger response. It's multifaceted. You have an initial reaction and response. So I've done this before, but we're going to do it again in case anybody hasn't seen it. So I'm going to do my brain, and I'm going to have y'all do it with me in just a second. So this is our brain. I want you to imagine that this is our brainstem, right? So this is like your spinal column, and here's your brainstem. Y'all see me? So at the end of this little spot of your brainstem is where your amygdala is. Your amygdala is governed, well, it's triggered by your thalamus. So you have a thalamus response to your environmental stressors. Your amygdala's job is to just scan the environment for threats. As I've mentioned to y'all before, that fight, flight, freeze. That's where that response, that reaction response comes from. When our brain is scanning that environment and it has that reaction, it comes from this primitive part of our brain. When this is handling business correctly, our brain looks like this. So we have the brain stem that is all deep centered into the center part of the brain. When there's a trigger that happens, you can kind of see it like your brain flips its lid, right? So there's some kind of a scan or threat that your brain is triggered. It doesn't have to be anything that you're even aware of. There are times where you can smell smoke, right? There's all of a sudden there shouldn't be smoke, and you're smelling smoke, and whatever you were just talking about is gone, and now we're going to focus on the smoke. So that primitive part of our brain, when it's functioning correctly and it's scanning for threat normally, we do fine. Whenever there's some kind of a threat, we go, uh-oh, and it flips that lid. When it flips the lid, do you see what happens to the rest of the brain? It's not available. We don't have it. So all we have is this primitive part of the brain, which is fight, flight, or freeze. If I'm in a situation where I'm afraid, which is typically the root foundation feeling for fear, that there's a fear foundation, or excuse me, for anger, there's a fear foundation. If I'm feeling afraid, and I don't know what to do, typically I'm going to try and run. Your fight, flight, freeze. Remember I told you all your brain picks it. You don't really get to pick it. If the flight option isn't picked or it's not available and I'm stuck, what's my next option? I'm going to fight, right? So that's exactly what happens when the lid is flipped, is we go fight, flight, freeze. The job of the brain is only to keep us alive. That amygdala's response is to make sure that we make it through this stressful situation. It's not concerned how silly we look. It's not concerned with how ridiculous we look. These people who are out here ranting and raving and looking like lunatics and are expressing all of that, what they're really saying is, I'm feeling something that's probably fear-based, I don't have the words to say it, nor will I ever be vulnerable enough in front of someone to admit it. So I will take this approach of lashing out and ensuring that I stay safe. And because we're in a pandemic time where everyone has an invisible virus that they could infect us with, we are seeing these interactions with strangers that are much more heightened than they ever have been before. So, John, in answer to your question, when that amygdala response happens and the anger response, so we have the amygdala and then it goes to the hypothalamus. When the hypothalamus gets triggered by that flipped brain, it releases hormones in the body. So when we feel anger, what we're feeling typically is fear. So we're going to get negative releases of hormones in the body. That's an immediate thing, adrenaline, the different stress hormones, cortisol, the different ones that flood us, that causes us to react. It gives us the energy boost that we need to react. Well, it also gives us the energy that we need to cuss and fuss and fight, carry on. So you have an immediate reaction and releases the brain from those hormones. But the thing about anger is those hormones have to regulate and get back down to a normal, healthy level. If you're operating from this fight, flight, freeze spot, instead of going up and coming back down normal and then having some other stressor a couple of days later, we go back up, we come back to normal. What's happening now is we're going up, we start to come down, something else happens, we start to come down, something else happens. Now our new stress level and hormone level and our norm is now here. So we're operating from a place where we're stressed and the chemicals in our body are keeping it going. So anger, yes, is flash, but then it has those long-term continuing effects if those hormones keep getting released in the brain.
Dr. Corsi, let me ask you this, because that was great, because it led me into two areas that I think primarily fuel a lot of this American anger. One is policing, and one is politics. And when we talk about fear, a lot of times people, and it's just me guessing, we look at fear from a physical threat. And I think sometimes people have this emotional thing, I don't want to lose the fight or the argument. They're afraid they may lose. Does the same effect, because we see it all the time with escalated incidences in policing, on either the citizen or the officer's part, and in politics. Everybody's so politically polarized. Can fear be more than just the physical that causes this reaction in the brain?
Absolutely. It's the anticipation that someone's going to hurt your feelings. It's the anticipation that someone's going to embarrass you. If you are picking up signs that there is something that's about to happen in your environment that you don't want to have happen, your brain gears up and is ready to respond. For those of us who have practiced and have been taught strategies and coping strategies along our careers or in life, we typically can handle them better. The feelings are the same. The reactions are the same. I got into a stressful situation that I did not want to find myself into, and it was a very scary situation for me. And as it was happening, I felt what I'm training y'all about. It was crazy. I haven't been in that level of an environment where I've had this reaction. But y'all, you can feel the stress hormones hit your kidneys and your liver. When your brain, when you're stressed and those hormones flood your body and you feel that heart pounding and your cheeks get flushed and your fists are, all of those things are happening, those hormones are hitting your bloodstream. It's carrying to your body what's carrying to your organs. So every time you get in this high-stress situation and your body reacts to it, you don't get to tell it to calm down, it's fine. You are forced to deal with whatever it is that's in front of you. That's why our environmental choices are so important. Because when we're choosing to stay in environments that are unhealthy and cause us stress, we literally are creating disease, dis-ease, not being at ease within our bodies. And that's what makes it so scary, because these hormone releases are happening all the time. You think about kids that come from tough places. If you come from a poverty-stricken area, we already know those ACEs, those adverse childhood experiences, and the effects that they have on our bodies long-term and on our brains long-term. We've kind of gotten used to the norm of whatever our society and environment look like, And so we've become desensitized to how this stuff is really affecting us. But y'all, this anger response and the hormones that it brings in the brain can literally kill us over time. It's related to all kinds of heart issues, of cancer, anything related to stress and inflammation. It's hormone stuff. So when you're flooding your body and your blood with these hormones, you have to know that there's consequences.
Mm-hmm.
And the more often that it's happening, the more often it's repeated.
Chief, I see you not from the police perspective.
No, I mean, she's 100% correct. What we're learning now in law enforcement is because of the nature of the job, these things happen quite often, right? So you get this adrenaline dump, the cortisol, in these encounters, critical incidents that take place over time. So these continue to build up in law enforcement day after day or week after week, month after month. Now you have a 20-year person that's got massive calcium buildup in their arteries. Some of this we're learning, or not some of it, all of it, we're learning can be preventive. So we've got to go step back. Younger employees that are coming into this profession, and we've got to look at the design of, you know, that wellness program, you know, the physical fitness part of it. We always talk about the mental health aspect of it, but that goes in hand in hand with the physical portion of it. So we've got to retrain and look at things differently than non-traditional law enforcement entities, where you just show up, you go to work, you go deal with critical incidents or traumatic issues. Rub some dirt on it, come back tomorrow. I mean, those are things that have got to be corrected in law enforcement agencies. You brought up kind of a topic that I wanted to discuss, and the science behind it is true. I mean, what Dr. Cruz is saying is 100%. I mean, I am not a scientist, but this is stuff that I'm learning as an administrator in this organization, and how do we keep our people fit? I think there's a lot of societal issues as well. I think the biggest one, when we start talking about why our people are so angry, and it's interesting how things work, is, you know, I did post about being in some serving leadership training this week. This is the topic that we talked about in governmental organizations was, you know, it's called swimming upstream, but it's based post-pandemic. How do we deal with the situation we're in now? One of the biggest things I got out of it was a lack of civility. We're finding that there's a lack of civility across a spectrum, and we're inundated and bombarded with it. I mean, all day, every day. You get on social media. Where do we see the Karen videos?
Social media.
What happens when you get on and watch the news? Right. There are polls that are out there, and I did a little bit of research yesterday when I had a little bit of downtime, but the anger level of Americans, and I used an NPR research poll that they did, has significantly increased prior from the pandemic time. We were mad. We were in the 60% percentile on the sample. Post-pandemic, we've gone up past that, and I think we're at 80-something. Interestingly, things that I found that four of the top five issues that people are upset or scared about all deal with healthcare. I mean, so people are very concerned about healthcare. We talk about, you know, these things that are driving society, but, this lack of civility. And I'm going to give an example. I'm going to give two examples. One of them is this show right here. You know, when we start talking about civility, when we talk about having differences of opinion, when we talk about, you know, facts coming out, and I look at it this way and I see it this way, et cetera, on. There's not anybody on this panel that loses their mind and starts screaming. I mean, we were having a conversation yesterday between John and Joe and I about an article that Joe sent us about somebody being released on bail. But there was no FU. There was no – it was a conversation back and forth, learning from somebody else. Well, Joe probably was FU, but it was learning from other people's perspective on how they saw this particular incident. Another one that I ran across, and it's called the DNC podcast.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not promoting these guys. I've very limited watch them. But if you look at this show, it is a far left liberal and a far right conservative. And they talk about the hot topic issues. They've been doing this for a decade. I mean, these conversations that these two guys have in most instances, and about 90% of the population would end up in a fight at the end of this show. But these two guys are friends. They could not be more polar opposite. I mean, I don't know how they do it, but they gave an example. They talked about, you know, we're all familiar with the baker that didn't want to bake the cake for the homosexual couple, gay couple. I tell them much about it, but this is what they talked about. And interesting perspectives is, do you want the government to come in and tell you what to do? And then, of course, the liberal side is you know, they admitted, you know, if this had been a person of color that was the baker or a Muslim, they would have had a little more leniency towards them. It was mind blowing, but the civility between these two people, and that's how stuff gets done. I mean, we said that multiple times. I think that, you know, we're inundated with. I mean, where can you go where you don't have anger? When somebody cuts you off in traffic, what do? I mean, be honest. I'm not asking you to tell people. Be honest with yourself. What are you going to do? You going to let it roll? Just mean, you know, now they're having a bad day or whatever. Majority of people don't do that. I've had to learn to do that. I honestly have, unless I'm driving my squad car, then I'll put my lights on you. But driving around my personal vehicle, social media. Do you see a post that you disagree with and comment? I mean, some of these polls out there talk about how there's a large percentage of people that will online feel obligated to be angered to comment on a post that they disagree with. Why is it that some people do that and some people just scroll on by? Interestingly enough, those that are 65 years of age or older don't have these levels. I think part of that speaks to the technology portion of it. All this stuff that I read pulled off the internet, you can go find it yourself, but I'm a big proponent of civility. I think we've lost that in government. We've lost that in politics. We've lost that socially. If somebody has a difference of opinion of you, and just as Dr. Cruz said, it starts to resonate in the brain. It starts to become defensive,
mm-hmm.
and that's when this happens. You say, hey, you know what? Abortion. Like, I'm pro-life. I'm pro-choice. And we have this conversation. How many of those work out well? Well, almost none of them, because people start getting upset because you can't change that person's opinion, and you're never going to. Mm-hmm. I mean, have you posted something lately that was maybe opposite of what somebody else's opinion was? Did you change their mind?
Nope.
No. But you just got angered. And so just as Dr. Cruz said, you get angered at that particular incident. And this is what I'm talking about. I don't want to say conditioning, but it is conditioning. Then you go home
mm-hmm.
and you turn on the news. And how many good, solid, positive stories are there on the news? None. You know, so then you're just angered and angered and angered, and you keep on going on. So you have to individually and retrospectively figure out how to basically love and laugh. And that's one of the other things that we learned from this topic. You're going to have to figure it out for yourself. You're going to have to quit being so pissed off. That's just the way that it is. And look, I am the world's worst. I'm the worst person to be given this information, because I've had to learn this as an adult in life, later in life. And it has personally made my life that much easier, just based on the profession and the job that I've gotten dealing with. But I think we need to get back to some civility amongst people and quit being so damn mad because somebody has a difference of opinion from you.
Amen.
I'll add to
that. Could I ask a question?
Yeah.
I want to keep it more important for 1 second. It's two parts. How do you, when you arrive to a scene and someone is anger, how do you, as a police officer, gauge that anger, the degree of that anger? Like, well, this could turn deadly. This could turn out to be a fight, a scuffle. How do you, as a police officer, but I'm going to do the second part for any law enforcement. And the second one is when you have a partner and he's up in a suspect's face, and you say, well, he's just standing his ground. But then that officer begins to grow angry because the person is not following his instructions. As a cop, you should be able to gauge your partner and say, y'all, this is not going to turn out right. And this is the reason why I think so many cops are choking people, stomping people, punching people, because their partners are not saying, hold up, Joe has reached his level. Let me step in. Any way you guys can.
John, the camera's
out. Wait, first of all, I resent the name Joe Ben. Let me just say this. The thing you just said goes back to a very basic normative value. Again, it goes to a standard across the board, and that is that you have to be accountable for your partner's actions. So let's just start there. The other part of that is the reality is a lot of the people know what buttons to push on certain officers.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
We as police officers have an obligation to take control of both. I mean, hence you have the Chauvin effect. Now, how do you gauge that? First off, everything is a dangerous event. As you've seen in the last couple of weeks, more officers have been killed in domestic, which we've been talking about on this show. We've responded to domestic incidents, wiping us out again. Why? Because they don't know how to respond and when to respond. And let me just say this and be very clear. There's nothing in any of these contracts to say I have to take an ass whooping as a police officer. Let me just clear that shit up. Now, that does not mean that I have to necessarily go out and punch you out, but I can defend myself. And that's where people get the lines crossed. Are police officers allowed to defend themselves? Police officers, because in their very nature, they don't know how to articulate the reason they took the actions they took. And if half these officers knew how to write reports correctly, half of them wouldn't be in the position they are today.
And you're right, but I'll add this dynamic in too. And I'm not saying this is going to work in San Francisco or NYPD. I was in a medium-sized department, and I was in a medium-sized city. Thank God I could make an impact in that city as an individual, not necessarily as a blue savior for the community. But, John, to your thing, when I went into something, officers have got to be given the flexibility to be who they are. I may not agree with, say, if Joe did something, and I'm just saying because Joe's a black guy here, but if Joe did something and I'm coming to that call, I may not know yet what Joe did or agree with what Joe did, but when I get there, guess the first thing Joe's going to identify with is a black officer here. Or if you're white, it's a white officer here. And people will build that mental focus on that person. I'll hear you where I'm not going to hear anybody else. I don't have to condone what they did. But if I'm able to resonate that I understand the other frustrations you go through in life because I go through them. Now I'm a human to them. They are likely to listen. See, that's de-escalation without going through the proper steps. And people will tend to be tribal, and they will identify with. We've seen these videos where we've heard people say, send a black officer, send a female officer. Why? Because they want to be able to first let me identify with the authority figure. Then I'm willing to some degree to communicate. Is that possible in all circumstances? No, it isn't. But a lot of times it's because the way the departments are, we're glad to have you here as a female, as Hispanic or white or Irish or black or whatever. We're glad you bring this cultural diversity to the department. It looks great on the city stats. Look how many black people we got, Hispanic people we got. It looks great. Be too much of that here. And then when the stuff hits the fan, and you get somebody who says, I will only talk to a black officer, they can't wait to find one. So I think you got to let people be who they are in policing. If I'm good enough to bring a set of values to you, for you to take a chance to spend all that money to hire me, and then you train me, which reinforces those values that you initially believed I possessed, that benefit the city and the citizens, why will you limit me in being able to be who I am to accomplish the task at hand, which is that particular incident, not the call 2 hours from now? So I think a lot of frustration for officers are you're not allowing me to be who I am. And some, if they have the freedom, won't, because a lot of departments will say, well, I don't like so-and-so because he's friendly with this guy who sells dope. Well, it's his job to sell dope. It's my job to catch it. Okay? Don't get mad, but you don't know how many shootings I stopped because of that relationship with that guy. And here's the thing, and I can only say from where I worked. For people to think that only the black officer can work the black community, that's bullshit, because I can tell you in the black community of Waco, East Waco, some of the most beloved officers in East Waco, which was predominantly black, not all, but predominantly black, were white. Were white officers. These disenfranchised communities do not care what color the officer is. They care about that bond, that relationship, that communication that comes. It might not be general order correct. It might not be all the way where the department's going to love it or the city's going to love it. But are you stopping people from getting killed? Yes, you are. And that's what's not measured. It frustrates officers. What leads to anger, frustration, and environment? Long answer.
And how all that together, though, the reason why community policing works is because it takes down fear. Think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Everything you just said is absolutely correct. If someone says send the black officer because it's the black suspect or, you know, the person you're dealing with, that's because that person is less likely to be afraid of a person who looks like them if that's their story. And this is where it gets tricky. The reason why Dr. Behavior has struggled with putting out a book is because it's not a one-size-fits-all. Everybody's personalities are different. The way you engage with the community is different than the way Chief engages, the way Joe engages. It's just different, and that's the way it's supposed to be. Because
exactly.
Here's the point of what we're talking about today. If I try to do it the way that Claire does it, and Claire's personality is completely different than mine, that will trigger my lids will flip. I will stress myself out trying to be something that I am not.
Amen.
If you try to make me be a bitch and fool, it's not ever going to work. If you want, I do a leadership training, and number three is the barking at and do what I say and Number four is the balance between structure and nurture. If you try to make me be structure all the time, I'll quit or I will lash on you. That is not who I am. And if you want my brain to flip,
mm-hmm.
put me in a position where I have to be ugly and disrespectful and I have to carry some machismo, whatever. That's not how I engage with people.
Mm-hmm.
So that will create an anger and fear response in me just because you're trying to make me be something and act in a way, in a role that doesn't fit me. As leaders, especially as servant leaders, you have to know your people. You have to know where they're more likely to react and respond and how they're more likely to handle things in a good way, and then you support them in those areas. It's not about training one way to fix it.
That's
but
right.
Everything you just said, spot on, it goes right back to the fear base. It goes right back to the brain and how we're relating and engaging with people. And that community policing is exactly what it does to take down that fear response. So that we don't have to be afraid of each other when we roll up to the call.
Hey, I was going to say, John, and, you know, just to kind of get back to the point that the partner thing, you call them down. And officers have to have the latitude to be able to do that and intervene when that level starts to get to where it's supposed to be. It doesn't happen in most instances, but that should be the norm. Engaging, yeah, I mean, I don't even know how to – I mean, actions speak louder than words.
Mm-hmm.
Body language is the telltale sign. That's the majority of communication. When you get out of the car, if you got the
shade,
cool Oakleys on, and your cool haircut like this guy, and you know you're all you guys seen him. You know who I'm talking about. That guy, that cop, that already starts off as a bad part of the call. But the de-escalation, and I know that's the buzzword, and we keep talking about that, but. Most of us that have been on here in law enforcement for some time, we already had de-escalation. We just knew how to talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that all of a sudden this has become such a big topic in de-escalation? But law enforcement has been around for hundreds of years, and there are people that are operating and have retired today that were able to do it when it wasn't called de-escalation.
Exactly.
We just knew how to relate to people. So, you know, the worst, it's kind of like that joke, the worst thing to tell your wife when she's mad is just calm down. But that doesn't work either. You know, getting out and having a real conversation. And, again, I think Joe, Clary, and Stan will say, you know, and there's differences in levels. I mean, the guy's out there, you know, knocking wood off the side of his house because he's so mad. Well, that's a different approach. Somebody standing in the yard with kinesiological cues about anger, that's a different approach. They got a weapon. that's a different approach. So each individual situation is going to be different depending upon information that we have and what we see as soon as we get there. And again, 90% of the incidents that we deal with when we go on these types of calls don't end up in anything other than a conversation, right? Whether it's a domestic, whether it's somebody's upset about a neighbor or something along those lines. You just have to know how to navigate, and you just have to know how to deal with people, you know. And we're not the best at it. There are great leaders out there, and there's a lot of great folks that you can model after that know how to do this. That's why when we start talking about field training, that's why that becomes so important, that you have a seasoned veteran, somebody that has been through the program, that has the ability to teach a young officer. Not everybody's going to try to kill you on a traffic stop. Mm-hmm. Not every contact is going to be deadly, but you have to remain. And it's a term that comes out of the book, but it's called hypervigilant.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the term where you're supposed to be over the top, but in our job, we have to be guarded. But there's just no two ways about it. And if you're not, then the potential for, you being shot or killed can escalate significantly. So, you know, head on a swivel, paying attention. You got to learn body language and cues. You got to learn inflection. You got to learn what the talk is when people are talking to you, what things are saying. If you go to like a hostage negotiation school, and I'm not very little known about it, but why is it that a lot of hostage negotiators can get people in very dire situations to walk out, right, through a conversation and they build rapport? They can also tell you when it's not going to end well. They can honestly tell you that there's only one way that this is going to come to a conclusion, and that's we're going to have to go in. And that's fact. That's just fact. So, you know, again, I wish there was a one-size-fits-all, just like Dr. Cruz said, but there's not. Dealing with people, and everybody is an individual. You have to know your audience and who you're talking to and how you have conversations with them, and that becomes important. That's a learning process. You got to learn how to do it.
Let me grab a caller real quick that's been holding for a while. 706 area code 5416. Good morning.
Good morning, Stan. This is Dr. Marla. How are you doing? It's been a while.
We're doing good. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's good to hear all you all on here. One of the things when I'm pardon me if I don't know everybody's name anymore because y'all have kind of a new group now too, but the lady that spoke about anger, you know, or the first lady that she broke it down clinically, which was actually excellent. But you know, the it goes deeper than that for the individual. You know, there's the number one emotions. You know, anger is like a secondary emotion, because the first emotions are like your sadness, your fear, your worry, your anxiety, frustration, disappointment, all those types of things. And so with that being said, you know, I'm a religious leader, I don't even like to say religious leader. I'm a Christian. I'm saved. I love the Lord. But anger is a matter of the heart more than anything. And I'm not talking about your pumping heart. I'm talking about the heart, the soul of a man, the soul of a woman. But the Bible tells us to be ye angry, but sin not. But what we like to do is skip over all of that other stuff and go straight to the sin, you know, because, you know, we can justify how we act out of things, you know, given the reasons why we may be angry. The real deal is anger is a matter of the heart. And when your heart is not right, which goes back to the foundation of love, and when you don't know how to love or you have not been loved, and we know that, I know that love is of Christ. Love, God is love. And so when you throw the things of God out of the family unit, you know, and you start, you have children or maybe you're the parent and you've been in situations where love hasn't been a part of your household, you stem that anger to your children. Therefore, they grow up with all these different emotions and don't know how to channel them, don't know how to understand them. You know,
right.
The reason there's sadness in the home because there's a lot of things that have happened. If there's fear in the home, what's happened? And not just in the home. I mean, it could not be maybe not your the home, but maybe there's a broken family. There's all that those different types of things that go that's where anger actually comes from. They exuberate it by acting out on things. That's all I wanted to share, you know, because there is clinical reasons, definitely, but, you know, it's deeper than that. It's way deeper.
Right. Well, we, as always, I appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you. Prayer. Take care, y'all.
Well, on that note, I would agree. The coping mechanisms, I think, is what she's referring to, though. When you have all that trouble in the home, or you have parents that are not available for the child, that's where, like, you just come into just, well, problems all the way around, and if you don't have any parents to teach you coping mechanisms or get you into programs that will teach you coping mechanisms, or you don't have a supportive school system or something like that that will get you there and help you get there, then it just, yeah, you probably do become very angry and upset at the system, and that's partly what Stan was talking about was letting you be yourself so that you don't have to be so upset at the system for not letting you be yourself and trying to fit you in a box that not everybody fits in. But the main thing that I wanted to talk about was that one size fits all doesn't work. And I wanted to bring Izzy in on this because I think he'll agree with me that in the police training portion, I think that a lot, something that needs to be brought in and taught is balance between like Joe's question about keeping your partner, your beat officer, under control. Well, like Joe said as well, that's not really your job, because everyone's personal mental health is their own
responsibility,
their own problems. They need to help handle their own mental health. So you can't really put that on another person to handle someone else's mental health and pull them off of somebody. You need to handle that on your own. And that's when you get into disciplinary problems and needing to address those systematically. And when those don't get addressed, that's where you get into the anger and that systematic anger. So I just want to bring Izzy in and talk a little bit about, like, police training and what can be done as far as like Dr. Behavior said, when that lid flips, what do you do and how do you balance that amygdala and what it does? How do you bring that lid back down to where you're containing yourself again? And I believe that's coping mechanisms, and I think that's what needs to be taught as well.
Is?
I mean, I agree with Claire. I will say that It's not being taught in general policing. They don't teach anything that Dr. Cruz just said. You're not getting in a standard issue police academy training program. Like, it's not happening. Cops aren't getting taught the science behind it, and they're definitely not getting taught how to actually deal with it. There are numerous stories across the board of officers coming out of the academy and having no idea how to deal with the adrenaline rush, how to deal with the stress, with the trauma, any of it. And then when they get to the department, there are no services in place for them to do that. So for starters, they need to actually try and do that, because for the most part, they're not. There's a little bit more development happening in smaller departments like the chiefs and stuff like that. That's ironically, but in your major departments, it's not really happening. There's nothing there in support of it. And for damn sure, most departments are not promoting an interventionist culture.
Mm-hmm.
That's just starting to happen in terms of conversations, and it's still not being implemented correctly, not being implemented well or at all. Most departments, when we talk about letting officers have the freedom to be who they are, that tends to be pretty applied fairly well to the officers that are out there, you know, beating the shit out of people and doing
exactly.
bad things.
Exactly.
Meanwhile, you have officers that are doing their job, that are actually engaging in community policing, and they're getting punished for it. So the general consensus that I've run into, especially among, say, for example, whistleblowers and stuff like that, is they get punished while the other officers get promoted, get allowed to continue doing what they do. So it goes back to that change in the culture. Right now, the culture in policing is still very much the high ceiling if you lie down mentality. Like, you don't push, you don't make waves. You don't push against the norm. You keep your mouth shut, you keep your head down, and you do your job within the parameters that they describe to it. But if you try to intervene, if you try to actually engage in community policing practices, if you try to promote those practices, you will get in trouble most of the time, depending on departments that you are in, because that's just the culture.
But you hit a good point right there, because you're right, and I think a lot of people hear that, when an officer promotes community policing or is close to the community and is not afraid to say, I understand what you all go through, and the city, we don't have this right. The police department, we don't really understand as well as we think we do. That's why we're not getting results. That officer takes a shitload of frustration off. A ton. Because you got people who don't, they view you, I'm trying to put it to where officers can understand. They don't see community police officers as cops. This is my friend or my buddy or my neighbor who happens to work at the police department. And that is where I think we ultimately need to be. Because when we strip our title away and deal with them with all of our authority, but deal with them where they're at in their life, in their crisis, we empower them to now when if somebody comes to me and says, well, how do I get through this? Stan doesn't have to handle it. I can say, let me introduce you to Bob. And Bob can say, hey, when Officer Mason worked with me, this is what I did to get through this. And then Bob helps that person. And then when the next person comes in the neighborhood, those two help. You go back and empower the neighborhood. We've got to stop saying we have all the solutions. Because those men and women on the street, the number one killer of us is suicide. It ain't people. It's us. And it's from frustration that comes directly from the workplace. It ain't all outside related. A lot of it is workplace-related stress that is unnecessary that goes down to those patrol officers. Because I think the majority of men and women out there, they want the best for these communities because they live in them. They deal with these people 40, 50, 60 hours a week. If their home and their neighborhood is shitty, my office is shitty. It's no better for me. I have to live in that. And so I think officers feel that. But you're right, it's either good officers who feel it and aren't afraid to say, you know, these people aren't all drug dealers and crazy. Yeah, they don't have money. Yeah, we can say maybe they can do better at this or that. But have you opened your eyes and looked at what the city is doing for them? Nothing. What do we as a department do for them? We just go there and put them in jail to make statistics to get people elected. We're not solving the problems. Well, these four officers over here are. Yeah, but look at what you did to them. What message did you send to Clarence to come out of the academy? Don't do that. Whatever you do, don't do that.
Yeah, I mean that's a lot of times that's the culture that's promoted. Is once you get out of the academy, it's like, okay, now you know this is what you have to do. Be quiet to get ahead, mm-hmm. and if you intervene, you're going to get in trouble. I mean, look at Carrielle Horn. Look what happened to her. I mean, mm-hmm. she intervened and her partner trying to assault a suspect. Mm-hmm. He assaulted her, and it took her how long before she finally got her pension?
Mm-hmm. 20.
Yeah.
But look at the young lady here recently. You know, her sergeant was going to mace a guy that's handcuffed in a car. She goes to pull him off. He grabs her by the throat. Now, here's the thing, and we're going to do a show on this. We're not going to open this can of worms today, but we're definitely going to do one on it. You know, here's the thing. That sergeant was wrong all the way across the board. Stevie Wonder can see he don't need a badge and a gun. Who came to his rescue? Who was it that came to his rescue? The police union. The police union. Here we come to save the day. I understand you have to represent the officer's rights. But who came to Derek Chauvin's defense when he did 20-some violations against him? Who came to his defense over there? The police union did. So, I mean, I think to the union means well for officers, and I'm not anti-union. I'm not. Because departments will screw officers and the union saves a lot of officers. But I think that unions are also saving a lot of bad cops and forcing chiefs who get thrown under the bus and get the negative media on them because you should have fired this guy in the chief's going, but guess what I did? Chief Fitzgerald came on here that was in Fort Worth. He talked about he wanted to fire the officer that assaulted and arrested Jackie Craig and her daughters. He said, I wanted to fire the guy. The union came back and fought me and they won. And a lot of people think the chief is the end-all, be-all. If you're in a civil service department, that chief ain't the end-all, be-all. That police union, because ain't nobody ran for political office yet. Judges, mayors, city council people, ain't nobody ran and said, you know, I want the chief's endorsement. They want that police union endorsement. The unions are important, and they do serve a purpose. But I think sometimes they're keeping rogue cops on a department, and then they're willing to throw the chief under the bus when the chief said 5 years ago, well, before he cost us $1.8 million, I wanted to fire him over here, and y'all told me no. And the union always escapes any responsibility. That's another show, but.
I mean, the number of officers that I, if you talk, it's all the officers that also represent marginalized communities. It's always funny how when shit goes down for them, they usually have to go to their own personal groups to get any kind of advocacy or support.
Mm-hmm.
The black officers have to go to the black police officers unions. Female officers have to go to the female police officers unions. They rarely can go to their main union to get the support they need because that main union is already defending the person that they're talking to.
And the amazing thing is indeed when you talk about these subdivisional unions within a department, the Black Police Officers Association, the Hispanic Police Officers Association, the FEMA, what's amazing is the city to some degree will give legitimacy to each one of these groups without understanding that everybody who are in these satellite groups are also paid members of the main department. But why did this entity feel the need to divide off and separate? Because their needs were not being met by the overall union. Nobody was hearing them. So here's a segment of people, whether we want to call them black, Hispanic, female, whatever that separate unit is. Now, guess what they are? They're frustrated. So then what do they become? They become angry. And what happens? They go out there on the street, and we deal with angry people and angry situations. And everybody says, why isn't the outcome rosy? Because everybody's angry.
And, I mean, that's actually one thing to bring it all together, speaking about police and just society in general. Another point I think we need to discuss is the fact that, you know, there are a lot of reasons to be angry right now. Like, as a police officer, everything we just talked about is enough to give you a reason to be mildly pissed off. So it's kind of, I mean, in the broader discussion of why are people angry, I mean, I think we need to examine the justifiable reasons they have to be pissed off. Because there's a lot of stuff going on right now that's worth being pissed off about. I mean, we talk about, we like to bring up, like, common sense isn't common or what was it? Civility isn't taught anymore or anything like that. Well, of course, how can we expect that to happen in this country if we keep, you know, shitting on the education system and cutting it every 2 seconds? If our education system keeps being as crappy as it is and keeps getting worse, how much longer can we keep putting it on the parents who just had that education system like 10 years before to, you know, improve their kids? I mean, look at the teachers. Why are they pissed off? Because they don't have any money and they're paying for everything in their classrooms themselves. You know, why are the police officers pissed off? Because they don't have any support. And media organizations are putting people into groups of either ban the police or Blue Lives Matter. You know, why are women pissed off? Probably because, you know, there's tons of sexual assaults every day that they're 90% of the victims of and nobody does anything about it. Like, why are all these people mad? Because we continue to not deal with the circumstances that lead to their victimization and persecution, and it just keeps to seemingly get worse. And nowadays, with social media and everything that you have, it's constant. You're constantly exposed to a different crisis, catastrophe, tragedy, terrible thing every day, constantly. And people like to, I mean, in the last year or two, people like to, you know, I still run into people who be like, oh, I can't believe how bad it's gotten. And I always try and argue, it's like, it's not that it's gotten, in some degrees it's gotten worse, but also a majority of the problem is now you're just seeing all of it. Because there's people in these groups that have been exposed and victimized by these problems for generations that are like, welcome, the water is warm, get in, and let's just see how terrible things can get. Like, and so there's reasons for people to be mad.
Well, I think the issue is now there's more than one gatekeeper of information. The social media platforms allow everyone to be a gatekeeper. But the real other construct that we're not talking about is that the fact that people can say anything without consequences. And that's a real problem. Certainly the issue of education is prime discussion. But the fact that people can say anything and the fact that knowledge has become almost passé not to say something inflammatory is more scary to me than anything else. I mean, the book that I recommended to Dr. Corsi, I think everyone should take a look at, called Mindfuck. And if you read it, would you agree, Doctor, that it's enlightening, particularly when we talk about this idea of gatekeepers? But the idea that because I don't say anything inflammatory, let's take Tucker Carlson. I mean, this guy just makes outrageous statements, just flies in the face of normative values, but he's not called to the carpet because he is media, and he can say it. That's not the case. At some point, you know, when we talk about civility, there has to be, and again, we're not going to use the term common sense, but there has to be a definitive level at some point where you just can't yell fire in a crowded, you know, room. And go ahead, Ed. I see you.
I mean, when it comes to media, there used to be, and they got rid of it. Like,
it's called used to be.
Yeah. Fairness doctrine?
Yes.
And they
Right.
And that's why these things can happen for the most part. And what you said is true, Joe. I mean, I think we also need to make a very – people need to pay attention to the fact that most of the media you're consuming is owned and operated by, like, 8 private corporations that have – their entire goal is making more money. And FYI, they make more money the more pissed off that you are. Like, the more pissed you are, like, and also, you know, just the more pissed off you are, the easier you are to distract and control, by the way. People that are really emotional and pissed off don't think.
Well, we saw that January 6th.
I will guarantee you this. I dare anyone, I challenge you tonight when you watch the news, follow this mantra. If it bleeds, it leads. Tell me what opens your media and tell me what it is. And I guarantee you, in 99% of cases, it's going to be a violent act.
Yeah. Almost 100% of the time. That's what leads.
Deeper than that. So I used to teach research with Carlson. I taught research methods. And so I would teach students how to ascertain if their sources were appropriate or not, right? So I taught this class. I started teaching back in 06. I taught till like 12, I guess. I taught it every year. And every year I could say, if it has a .com, if it has a .org, right, I could go through and I could explain all these different things and I could come to you and I could say, okay, if it's one of the large ones, if it's an MSNBC, if it's a CBS, if it's an ABC, those are, you're good. About 4 or 5 years ago, I started noticing that those reputable, print of fact people started putting in their political spin and their political
ideology.
Yeah. It's subtle. It is so subtle. But because I taught it, and I used to teach students who were, you know, connoisseurs of research and making sure that we're not citing the wrong things and putting out bad information and all that, that mattered to me. And I'm sitting here reading things that I previously would have, I did instruct my students, trust them. I cannot, if I teach that class today, I cannot. There are some people out here who are on private Facebook or private websites that are typing in the things, the research that they have done that is more reputable than many of our major corporations, because that person is not under any kind of political or money influence. Mm-hmm. They are specifically going for the facts.
So when we talk about being gatekeepers, we also are producers of information and things that we've never been able. We used to be able to track our news. I haven't watched news in 4 years. I pick up, I go to different sites, I look at the sources, and I look at the stories, and then when I read it, I think to myself, now how much of that was accurate? How much of that was twisted?
Mm-hmm.
If you go back to the Chauvin, the press release that Minnesota sent out, as soon as the shooting happened, they put out a press release. I screenshotted. I got it in my phone because I was sure curious how that was actually going to go down. And when you read that press release and when we see the 9 minutes of tape, that ain't accurate. And what's happening now because of social media, I believe, is that people have been able to fact check for themselves. People before had to just, we just got the newspaper. That's all we had. We just had to take it for what it was. Now, if it doesn't sound right, I can go with Google. I can go out here and find things and keyword
That's
things.
Right.
I can link things together and be like, wait a second. And so what does that create? Mistrust. If I can't trust you to lead me, if I can't trust you to give me good information, I'm on my own. So everything that y'all just said, I'm going to tie back up into a pretty robust education. For years and years and years, we send our kids to school. What side of the hall do we walk on? The right-hand side of the hallway. Which side of the street do we drive on?
Right,
the right-hand side of the street. Our schools were foundations for our society. We had be respectful, be responsible, be safe. Those were the three rules that every school across this country, safe and civil school. We had certain basic foundations and values that we put in. You don't use those words. We don't talk like that at school. You be nice to your friends. You help him, don't hurt him. All of these things that we teach from the time that children come into our institution all the way up, that was a foundation, and that was what teachers were expected to do a good chunk of their day. Then we started getting into accountability and testing. We don't have time to teach you social skills anymore. I don't have time to correct you when you're ugly and say something ugly to Steve, so I just tell you to go sit down and speak too. So now little Stevie's sitting over there feeling like his teacher doesn't care about him because she doesn't have time. She's trying to get these math standards that are supposed to be because we got a test that's coming up and a benchmark on Friday. Do you understand what I'm saying? Our values have gotten out of whack. We value money. We value capitalism. We value all of the outcomes that come with those pretty little reports and those dollar signs. But we are not paying attention to what we are sacrificing in order to get it. We have, if you go into any school right now, you will be mortified at how these children are acting. Mortified. And you would be as mortified at how the teachers are acting. You know why? Because everybody is surviving in a cesspool with no values that are consistent. And so everybody's fending for themselves. These babies are out here fending for themselves. Who's taking care of them? Who's protecting them when the bully says something ugly? Hell, the teacher's been bullied down to nothing, and now the teacher is the bully. That brain, that flip lid, they're everybody's operating like this every single day. How much connection is happening right now? It's not. So I say all that to say, as a society, we're going to have to come back together, and we're going to have to agree on what our values are, and we're going to have to fight tooth and nail to make sure that we are upholding it and doing what it takes to make sure that people are doing it. Because if not, the children are showing you what's coming. The violence, the aggression, the fighting, the ridiculous in schools right now, and y'all, they're hiding it. They are hiding it. That's why all these cell phone videos are coming up. Those are kids. Those are kids that are videotaping the conditions in their schools and putting it out. It is far bigger than we even know. Law enforcement's just catching the backside of it. You're just getting the outcomes from all of it. But it's rooted right now in schools where we're not correcting kids who are disrespectful to teachers. Don't say anything to them. No consequence, no nothing. So they're meandering through life thinking that this is okay and this is acceptable. And that's what you see on the street and at Burger King and everywhere else because nobody's correcting it.
Real quick, if you guys don't mind.
Great.
I'd like something that you kind of said, like pretty much everybody has a reason to be angry, right? But Jim brought up some earlier about the cameras, the videos of the cameras. And one thing that I noticed, they all are angry, but that anger doesn't mean violence, right? because in most of those cases, there's no violence attached. There's no violence attached to it. At what point do the anger attach to violence, or is the violence and anger separate? Because, and I'm only saying this because my experience is, I started off in a situation angry, but by the time I went to go do what I was going to do, I was no longer angry. I was just, man, it's a principle, or my ego. So where do violence get attached? And we kind of give kids a little pass because, oh, he was upset over this. Someone explain.
I'll give you a short answer. Actually, I'll let somebody else. Go ahead.
Well, I think that's a two-part question, at least for me. When does anger become attached? Now, the courts have defined that for, let's say, in the case of a violent crime or a murder, they call it a cool-off period. Mm-hmm. That means you go from point A to point B. Now, that point A to point B could be as small as from 5 feet to 2 feet or around the block. The fact that you were able to turn a corner becomes a cool-off period. When does it attach itself? It attaches itself when one becomes so overwrought with the feeling, or the endorphin dump, as I like to call it, that their fight or flight syndrome is fight no matter what. And what turns that? No one, at least in my mind, I've not been able to sufficiently quantify that. So it's a great question, and I think it varies from case to case.
And a short answer to you about the way to tell. So this is what I teach teachers. If someone has words, then their lid is at least two. Right? If someone has words. If someone does not have words, they are fully flipped, and they do not have the ability to have rational thought in that moment. So that's always a telltale. If you come up to somebody and you're trying to talk to them and they're grunting at you, that is the most primal reaction that a person can have. You cannot communicate and have any level of anything happen at that point. The only thing you can do is take a deep breath and take a deep breath and take another deep breath. That's that disengagement. In answer to your question, John, anger is a choice. The things that result out of anger are choices. Now, there's a short little break in there, but because we justify it, because we've all been angry and we all felt bad about it, but we all point fingers at whoever started it or caused it or the reasons and the blaming and the excuses and all of that, it becomes easier for us to say, oh, it's okay for you being mad and acting like that. No, it's not. No, it's not. We have to set a standard for ourselves to say it's not okay for you to victimize somebody else because you had an emotional reaction. We all have emotional reactions. Now, some of us have more reason to have higher, faster, quicker, more – yes, absolutely, of course. Should we have empathy for those people? Absolutely. Do they need support?
Absolutely.
But we cannot just keep saying, oh, that's okay. It's okay that you grew up. It's okay that you punched your face. It's okay that you said that. We understand you were mad. No, that's not okay. I didn't like it when you punched me in the face. I didn't like it when you talked to me like that. Don't talk to me like that again. Do it again. There's a boundary. You don't have access to me anymore. Those are the things that people aren't willing to do to ensure that they're safe, to ensure that those boundaries are in place. It makes us uncomfortable. What do we just talk about with our brains? When we're uncomfortable, we don't make the same decisions that we would if we were having full brain.
Yeah, and that's your example. That's where that de-escalation begins when you have that. So the point I wanted to bring up, based on what you just said, you know, everybody thinks that it's a silver bullet. It's not. It doesn't. Mm-hmm. I mean, if somebody is at that state, they don't have a thought of they can't rationalize. They don't have a conscious thought. How do you de-escalate with somebody? That can't rationalize. That's where some of this problem comes in, because when we teach I've said this in the past, when I teach that same information between the lizard brain and the human brain, when we start talking about civilian response to active shooter, when we teach our citizens about getting involved in one of those, it's getting out of that lizard primal brain and get into the human thinking brain. That's where you can make rational decisions on how to get through or get into fight or flight. Because when you're in that primal brain, you can't even make the decision either to fight or flight. You've got to, you still got to come back a little bit and figure out what we're going to do. You know, if I'm trapped, then we have to fight. If I can get out, then I get out. So when we explain that to citizens in that context, so we're talking about active attack, active shooter situation at that level. But it's still the same, even with Dr. Cruz's example of dealing with a student or a parent that's at that level. I mean, so it's the same across the board. I think that's what people need to understand. So when we get into the de-escalation talk in law enforcement, yeah, it is needed, and it has its place, but it doesn't work all the time either. So I mean, you can't put that on there. Now look, I see you was about to talk. There are a lot of instances where de-escalation, what should have been put in place, and that we in law enforcement were absolutely 100% wrong. We just acted, right? But there are also going to be incidences in the future, and when we talk about law enforcement, there is never going to be a 100% police utopia. Just let's just get that out there, because there are going to be bad people in this world, right? That this doesn't work with. But again, the majority of the 98% of the population that we deal with, this does work. So, you know, look, when somebody is just at that point, there's no rationalization. John, your question, I agree with Joe. It can be a very fine line from anger to physical action and violence, or it could be one of these that, you know, hey, I cooled off, I went down the road, 2 days later, pops back up, I start thinking about it, and I go get them. So, I mean, I've seen it from instantaneous to a week apart. I mean, so, I, you know, that's a very interesting question on how that correlates with one another.
Well, go ahead, Eric.
For myself, I mean, in terms of what we're talking about, I think, first of all, just a little thing on the utopia. I love that people always bring up, like, utopia. And I had to study utopia in school. And, like, the funny thing about that story is that it's a paradox. It actually, you can't ever achieve utopia, because the moment you keep something utopic, it automatically contradicts itself.
Right.
But I think in this conversation, what's really important to talk about is the availability of resources. So, like, what the chief just said about being able to, like, have that break, de-escalate and everything like that, being able to do these things all depends on an availability of resources to get the training, to get the education, to get whatever to be able to do these things. And I think to get to what John was asking, when we talk about that line between anger and violence, I think we also need to consider the fact that we can pinpoint where the majority of violence in this country is happening and the communities that they're coming from. Communities that are usually the most violent have the least amount of resources. And what that violence is met with is mostly enforcement. Usually what we meet these with, it's happening here in New York. Eric Adams just rolled out a new way of handling gun violence. It's not new. He's just bringing back his gun violence teams, and he's meeting these communities with enforcement. And while I acknowledge that we do need police to a certain point, I'm always, like, amazed that we keep repeating history and just hitting these areas with more enforcement, more policing, even though historically it hasn't worked. We just keep hitting him with that. But then we ignore the studies and the research that show that if you focus on putting resources into those areas, if you focus on rebuilding housing, rebuilding public areas, funding community support, doing all these stuff, those have all been statistically shown to decrease the violence that we're trying to tackle. But that's never the plan that anybody launches. Usually the plans that the city went in a city or a town or a community hit the headlines, it's all about how, oh, we hired new policing, we created this new task force, they're going to be better because we gave them jackets, and there's going to be a guy who goes around the police department who occasionally checks on them. And, you know, that's what we did. There's never like, hey, we just launched a major housing building campaign. We're going to go into these areas and we're going to build better homes. We're going to repair piping. We're going to do this. We don't do that. We always hit it with more enforcement. And I think that when we have this conversation about what makes people go from anger to violence, it's that continued contact with just a violent response to what you're doing, which is natural, as we've said, to a certain degree, but it's two sides hitting a head against the same wall. Like, we're not going to get anywhere if we keep just meeting these problems with more enforcement, more punitiveness, more punishment. Like it doesn't correlate to improvement, and it just creates more resentment, and it creates more possibilities for anger, and it's why you get things like riots and stuff like that, because they reach a certain point to a certain degree where it's going to boil over. If you keep denying people a certain level amount of quality of life things and just keep hitting them with enforcement, this is what's going to happen.
I agree. I mean, I 100% agree. You got to go find what the root cause of that problem is, right? And,
like, where's the bathroom in the park? Like, yeah.
I mean, what is the root cause? What are the things? And we said it on the show, and for those that may be listening for the first time, you may be very surprised in a very low socioeconomic crime-ridden area what those people see as the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I love your story, Stan, about the sidewalk. You know, that right there in itself proves, if you go and you talk to the people and you find out what the root causes of these issues are, you may be very surprised. It's not enforcement. It's not put more people in the area. It may be city resources. It may be social services. It may be, you know, whatever it could be. But and it's all a package deal. Right, not one thing. Not social services isn't going to fix everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you know, the construction of facilities or whatever, and enforcement. So it's that package deal that is supposed to be put into place that will reduce. I believe will reduce a lot of these problems versus just going out there and hammering people. I do like the guy with the new jacket. I wish somebody kind of give me a new jacket. Did they say something on it? Is that it's new?
No, the original gun task force from a few years ago was like completely undercover. You couldn't identify any of the officers. So now he's bringing them back, and they're like, this is the same thing. He's like, oh, no, we're going to have them wear jackets. And they'll say, like, something on the back of them. They're still going to be in unmarked cars, and they're still going to be plain clothes. But they'll have, like, a, you know, poncho. So, cool.
Hey, let's do this real quick. We're at the 35 minute mark, but I want to go into this part of it that impacts every one of us on here individually, every listener, everybody who's ever going to listen to this. This one thing nobody can say I don't have. Let's talk about that one person in your life that's a friend. Cringe sometimes. You call, you want to check on them, you love them. But they just are full of constant negativity, constant anger, and I call them psychic vampires. They just sap your strength. You wake up in the morning, you're in a good mood, but after you listen to I don't know how you wake up. The sun has just come up. The birds are wiping sleep out of their eyes before they chirp, and this person's already mad at the world. How do we – that person impacts us because there's somebody we care about. So we juggled that's what you get. That's what your cup of coffee. You know, I mean, at some point, we all have that one person that we're just, yeah, they're my friend. They may be a family member. And we're just like, oh, my God. I don't even want to hit call because it's going to be a bucket of negativity for the next 40 minutes. And these are the people who will ask you, well, what do you think? And they'll ask you for help, and you'll tell them. And they won't do it. And tomorrow, they've got another story. So they add to your stress level with everything that we are individually, whether you're a police officer, a teacher, whatever you are as a person walking out. So really, how do we fix it from our point? Because I'm a firm believer that I have to first fix Stan to impact Stan's neighborhood, to impact Stan's city, to impact Stan's county, to impact Stan's state, then to change the country or policing or whatever it may be. And so how do we, and Dr. Corsi, this is a lot of you, but how do we tell people sometimes enough? I can't deal with this no more. I love you, three-letter word that's out there, but, and some pain is coming behind it probably. How do we do that constructively?
Another three-letter word is Joe. Don't answer the phone. Don't call. Because we turned into a show about co-hosts now.
Oh, Oh, oh no, and for the record, I wasn't talking about Joe.
Oh, okay, my fault.
There's some strategies you can do. Here's the thing, for us as humans, as angry as we are and as demonstrative as we are when we act out all of our emotions, we are the worst about having direct conversations. We are the absolute worst at saying, every time you call me, it's negative. Is there anything positive going on today?
Mm-hmm.
Can you find one thing today that's positive that you'd like to talk about? And what will happen is that person will get, man, they'll have a reaction, little flip, right? Because you're trying to take away their habit. Most of the time when they're grown and adults, the habit, this is where they focus. They have a pessimistic / realist. You'll get that, I'm a realist. You're a pessimist, right? Like, reality is everything doesn't suck all the time. That's not the reality. So the fact that you're choosing to focus on that, once again, we come back to that choice thing, right? Setting boundaries is huge. Being a mirror, if everything that they say is negative, mirror it back and everything that they say back to them. Don't try to be their sunshine. Don't try to be their optimist. Don't do that. When they're telling you how much their life sucks, man, it really sucks. Well, how bad did that go? Get them to go deep and talk about it. I'm serious. Y'all, when you're dealing with somebody that these are their habits and you're on the other end of that and you're trying to remain connected to them, the strategies that you have to use are very mirror-based. They have to be able to hear and see themselves. Most of the time they don't because they're coming to the optimistic person, the sunshine. Their darkness is clouded by your sunshine. When they come to you, your sunshine lights it all up. So they don't see how dark they are. They don't realize the cloud that they're bringing them. So being able to say it. And I'll just tell you, for me, I'll just say, I don't have the capacity for that today. If you want to talk about something happy, if you want to talk about something positive, I have space for that. The negativity, I don't have space for it today. And I've had people say, well, I don't have anything else to talk about. Okay, I'll talk to you again soon. Have a great one. Boundaries. I don't have to listen to your shit.
Exactly.
You have to protect yourself, for one, because negative energy will attach itself to you. And you'll find yourself arguing with your kids, arguing with your spouse. But the problem that I have that sometimes people need an outlet, because as you guys were talking earlier, anger builds up. It's not just one thing. It's you guys talked about having a bad day at work, come home, turn on the news, and the first thing somebody goes, oh, look at this shit. Gas is going up. The president did this. It's a buildup of things, right? So some people do need an outlet. But there has to be a balance, right? You know, and the problem is that we have become so receptive to being people outlets that, and some people don't want to look in the mirror at themselves if they own negativity.
Mm-hmm.
So they enjoy listening to somebody else's negative shit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So they're constantly listening to somebody else's negative shit. So people feel like they can come to you and pour their shit on you,
mm-hmm.
right? So now you haven't had enough. Now you want to be able to, not today. The person like, damn, maybe we were just chopping it up about, you know, just yesterday. Oh, I want to continue that conversation from earlier. You have to, someone has something negative to say about Joe. Usually I don't talk to Stan. When Stan says the things that he say, I say, Stan, if you're not going to put Joe on the phone, we're not going to have this conversation. So that's just me, the way that I do it.
I can't.
Hey,
right.
Joe.
As soon as Stan started talking about the topic, I thought about Joe.
Joe,
Joe, under the I agree with Dr. Cruz. I mean, you know, setting those boundaries become important, and I've had to learn this because I'm the world's worst about telling. I can't say because we're gonna fill up the swear jar, but. You know, setting the boundaries of I'm just not going to listen to you. And I've got I've got family members, I've got friends that this happens with. It's like, look, you know, that's cool, whatever. And you know, I do let them fall down into their own little rabbit hole about, oh, it sucks and this. Oh, man, that's horrible. Tell me more. You know, but there's a point where you can just only take so much. So it's an art, and you've got to work at it. But I was going to say, when you do get to that point, kind of like what Joe was saying, or John was saying about the outlet, you have to have solid coping mechanisms. And I wanted to point out that we suck at teaching coping mechanisms to people on proper ways to deal with the type of stress. And I think that becomes an issue. It gets even worse when you're trying to teach 30, 40-year-old people how to have coping mechanisms, solid coping mechanisms to deal with the stress and the anger that they've got, because that's interesting. You know, I do that with my children. I try to teach them, you know, hey, this is a good way to deal with this, and it's a good way to deal with that. And I think as parents, we need to make sure we all do that. But across the board, we suck at teaching coping mechanisms. It's horrible in law enforcement. To go back to what Claire was talking about and Izzy talked about, we don't talk about, we don't keep train that. It's not there. And again, I'm still a huge proponent for making these academies much longer than they are, mm-hmm. because that's stuff that needs to be taught. That needs to be addressed, and it needs to be trained upon that, you know, when you're getting into this business, these are the things you're going to see. And when it begins to affect you, then you need to have these strategies in place, or getting them ready to be in place to deal with these issues as we move forward.
Let me add, thank you, John, for that brief introduction. But I would tell you this. There is a famous line uttered by two great people, nattering nabobs of negativism. It was attributed to Spiro Agnew and to Batman. And in Spiro T's case, he was referring to the media. But in that, one of the coping skills is listening. That's one of the skills we don't teach the police. If some of these guys would just shut the fuck up, maybe. And again, part of the escalation is learning how to listen. So when it comes to the nattering nabobs, you can get away from them by letting them. Sometimes you have to listen. Now, and again, I agree with, you know, the boundaries have to be set. But being an adult, it's knowing that you have to listen. Do you listen to your kids? Why wouldn't you listen to a victim?
Most people don't listen to their kids, by the way.
Hey, okay, well, you try living in house, you'll hear a bunch. But
no, you're right.
Listening to them. Yes.
Active listening.
Joe.
Yes, sir.
I mean, people we know that committed suicide or went out and murdered someone, and we said, damn, man, he tried to call me, but he always goes on the rent. You never know when it's that time.
Well, here's another strategy. If you have those people and you just have to deal with them, this is what I ask them. Would you like my help or are you venting?
But again, that's still require listening.
Absolutely. If you're not going to disengage, right, if you're going to choose to have the engagement, then you need to have it on your terms. It can't be when someone's bringing you that negativity, they don't get to call that shot. You're choosing to allow that to come into your space. So when you're choosing to allow it to come into your space and you're choosing to engage with it and you're staying with that conversation and listening, it's absolutely imperative. If you're venting to me, all I'm doing is listening.
All I'm doing is listening.
I may ask questions to clarify, but all I'm doing is listening. And when you finish and you look at me, I'll look at you and say, how do you feel? Do you feel better?
And another part of de-escalation is HTFU. Bam, that's it. Move on down the road. You know, and I mean, that's done or get that way. But Claire, you've been listening tentatively.
Please tell us what is HTFU, whatever it is, FU. What is that, please?
I'm not filling up the job for you, Joe. Thank you. Claire, what do you think? Because your generation's got most of this figured out, that we old people are stressing over with high blood pressure.
Here we go.
Well, I'm not going to go into that, but I did want to make a point Chief's point that he said, when you get into this business, you're going to see a lot of bad blank. We need to continue that conversation to be had in the academy, because it usually just ends that when you get into this business, you're going to see a lot of bad crap, but need to continue that conversation to hold your own accountability for the crap that you're going to see and the way that you're going to react to it. So that's what I'm, that's all I have to say about that.
I do have some quick suggestions. John and Dr. Behavior is always going to bring some strategies for you. We've already hit on a lot of them, but I kind of have to sum them up. If you're dealing with anger, you're dealing with frustration, you're dealing with these things, or you're dealing with that in your environment, there's some things that you can do. First and foremost is disconnect. Disconnect. If you're getting upset on social media, get off of social media. It sounds counterintuitive, but
novel concept.
We can't, right? There's serotonin issues with the brain too, and the release of the social media stuff, the acceptance and being part of a group. Y'all, this is deep. It's deep stuff. So disconnect from the unwarranted source of the emotion. Don't stew on it. You got to cut it and move on. Replace that thought with something else and move on with something else. Be aware of your own self-check-in. You need to be able to be assessing of yourself. Use your words. Not just the bad words, not just hurt. You just walk out of the room when they leave. But use your words to the person who can actually affect the change that you need to be affected in your life. If you're uncomfortable and if someone is at the root of that, that person is the one who will help you fix it. You have to talk to that person. Monitor social media and your news, as we already talked about. Seek help from a professional. If you are struggling or if it is in any way impeding your life or the people around you, then you need help. Get help. There's no stress in that. But here's where my focus is. I need you to be. Be silly. Be creative. Be active. Be productive. When anger and that nastiness is all around you, the best thing that you can do is create, be, and do. It's very easy to get stuck and then have our minds sit us down and feel like we're stuck in muck and mire. The best way to get out of that is to literally walk away from it. So do something else. Get creative. Go outside, put your feet in the grass, ground yourself, just enjoy life's energy. There's so many different things that we can do, including just blowing it all out, cutting it off, and saying, I'm done, right? Something as simple as that and taking control of your space and saying, all right, that's enough. I don't want to feel that anymore. We want to do something else.
Well, you ought to be teaching in the academy down there. Chief, y'all need to get her to come in and teach a session in the academy.
Well, you know, it's interesting you said that because I just had a thought that come through my head. I'm going to get with Dr. Cruz offline and we're going to have a discussion. But, you know, we said about that serotonin and the social media. Isn't there research out there about that being at the equivalent of like heroin or something?
It might shut the exact same parts of your brain as cocaine. Any social media, drugs, love, they all light up the same parts. Similar parts of the brain, which drives us to those behaviors. That's why we keep going back to that.
Hang on, I got to check mine real quick.
Oh, you need some more hand puppets there,
Chief. You know, you brought up a really good point about talking to your kids. Here's the thing where I think we're all missing the boat. This is a chapter in my book. Y'all, my book is still coming. The 21st Century Human, Cool, Calm, and Connect. All of these conversations, this is what it's all about. The talking to your children is where we're missing the boat. We have mistakenly believed that children learn by osmosis. And we do, but not the best way. So the problem that's happening, in my opinion, and in my experience in working with kids, is if you don't ever sit down and talk to kids, you can actually hear what's going on inside their brain, and you can correct the things that are wrong. Because kids mistakenly take in things. If you get a divorce when your child is 8 years old, I guarantee you that when you tell your child, the child will say, if it's because of the shoes I asked for the other day when we didn't have money, I'm sorry. They immediately go to self. They're self-centered in everything that they do. So the world revolves around them for better or for worse. So whenever they're taking in the environment, they are assuming the worst in every scenario because their brains are trying to take in the things that are happening in their environment. So they're learning all the time. If you tell someone, don't hit, and every time they get in trouble, don't hit them. That doesn't match. Well, so I can't hit my little brother, but you can hit me, but you're bigger than me. And you see, I'm not saying don't. I'm not
right,
getting
right,
to finish, but what I'm saying is pay attention to the messages. We give contradicting messages all the time. We tell people, we go to church and say be kind to people, and then we leave and we talk about what Sister Hattie had on her hat. Like, it doesn't match, because we're sensing messages that don't match. So we have to teach our children how to think through, how to problem solve, how to anticipate what's going to happen next. And to your point, Chief, when we were talking about police officers doing that and the de-escalation conversations we had, it takes time. Do you want to know why police officers don't de-escalate? Because they got another call. They're on their way. They don't mentally, they don't think that they have time. And the thought of spending time in a stressful situation that they already don't feel equipped to handle makes it even worse. So what is that? Please get out of there. Close out the call and get on. And then that person's left kind of dealing. It's not the cop's fault. I'm not blaming. I'm just telling you the reason why it doesn't happen is because it takes time. When we do all of that, training children, speaking to them, telling them how to think, instructing them on how to think through a situation, especially if someone's been ugly or said something that has imposed a label or some type of ugliness on them, we have to teach them how to say that's not accurate, but that's not true, though. Yes, it is, he said, but it's not, though. Let's think about, you're not ugly. Look in the mirror. On Facebook, I posted a picture of you the other day, and there are 93 people who said how beautiful you are, right? We have to learn how to teach, because the enemy's trying to keep them to believe that it's one way, and we've got to come in and we've got to reinforce it with something else. So if you really want to help us as we move forward in this, teach your children how to think through and problem-solve and communicate their needs, and we will be in a much better place 30 years from now.
Yeah, that's true. Again, in that research that I did, my limited research, and the group that is the most stressed and the most angry, it's not this group here. It's the generation that's out now, the Z's. They're all over the place. And so, you know, again, I think what Dr. Cruz said, 100% accurate. You got to talk to your children. That the law enforcement, you know, we call it tripping, you know, running through the problems before they actually happen. And that's been proven to be effective a lot, because the brain can't process, you know, it doesn't know the difference between conscious and subconscious thoughts. So when you do these tabletop exercises or run through incidents, you pre-plan, actions will actually follow what you pre-plan. So, you know, that's a big part of training that I think that is not talked about a lot and put into place. And that's something that needs to be acted upon in these academies and script and go through a lot of this stuff, just with the muscle memory and the things that the physical actions we do, but thinking through calls for service when you deal with that angry person or that armed individual, that way your mind is already set as you arrive on the scene and it's not flipped up.
And Chief, and I would say also, though, when we talk about, because, you know, we oftentimes, and I use example academies, I think we need to get a whole lot more chiefs and assistant chiefs. Maybe they need to take their ass back to the academy too, because Dr. Corsi's right. I've mentally have been there. I need to get through this call and get to this. We got these calls holding on the screen. This many people are out of the jail. These guys were on a murder. There's only 8 of us on the street. There's 20 calls on the screen. We're trying to please the administration and the sergeant, who ain't taking no calls. So I think that when all that frustration is on that beat officer, but I say to this, who is that beat officer trying to please? It ain't the citizen. It's the sergeant to keep him off his back and the commander.
But it goes
back into, when, for lack of her example, policing is driven on statistics, not problem solving today. That's why we're going to the same calls at the same house constantly, because the officers are frustrated because I can't take the time to help Dr. Corsi with her call, because my beat officers are on the radio asking me, how much longer are you going to be? And they're sending car messages to the sergeant. He's been over there 20 minutes. How much longer are they going to be? Or the commander. And so all that weight is on who? That man or woman out there with that badge and that gun that's in the middle of shit central, they're catching flack from the people they're trying to help, and they got their beat officers in their ear, or they got a bunch of messages on their computer. And I think, and I'm talking about your medium-sized cities and above, like the one I was at. You know, it's nice to say we're community police-driven and all that, which is semantical bullshit. If you're not giving that beat officer time for him or her to work that call, that may not be a murder next week or a suicide next week, you're not policing. You're just responding to calls.
Now, Orga's, I got anger. Let me show you my anger. My anger when you said the sergeant not taking a call.
Mm-hmm.
Bull.
Mm-hmm.
There is nobody that's not going to take a call. That's an organizational issue.
Amen.
I have deep problems with that. For me personally, if I can go take a call, you can go take a call too. So in those instances, there should be nobody that is not available to go deal with situations as they arise.
Right. But Chief,
but you're right. There are instances, and you're 100% correct. That's organizationally, that's across the board in law enforcement, and they get frustrated, and you're 100% correct. I agree with you. But I just want to talk about the person not taking call, because
that is significant from a stress point, an anger point. I'm talking to individuals, because that individual officer who's in the middle of whatever, he's heard this call go out 4 times this month to this house. He or she says, I'm gonna find out what's going on here. Because we're wasting a lot of time here. So now we're going to invest time in problem solving. And then when a sergeant comes over the radio and asks you on an off channel, how much longer are you going to be? There are calls holding. And you haven't heard him check out on any of those calls holding? You think in your mind, well, hell, you got a badge and a gun. How about you go take a call? And officers, of course, can't say that. But that becomes frustrating now because I got the incident here I'm trying to help that I'm not going to be able to fix because you won't let me. And then you're over here screaming at me, why don't I do more, and you're doing nothing.
And that's not to belay the issue, but that's part of the culture shift in law enforcement that needs to happen, number one. Number two, that's leadership training from those first-line supervisors and mid-management on how to proactively address those issues. And rather than how long are you going to be there, it should be, hey, you need any help.
Exactly.
And then you go back to the culture of the organization being, I'm not getting on your rear end, but I'm trying to assist you to figure out what you're doing there. And when you say, hey, look, you know, go to B. Hey, look, I'm trying to figure out why we've been out here 5 times this week, trying to figure out what we can do to keep from coming out here. Then that answer should be sufficient enough for a supervisor to say, okay, cool. What do you need? Do you need another officer? Do you need assistance? And organizationally, that's how things should be, and that's how they should work. They aren't that way, but we need to move towards that. That ties very well into the topic that we're talking about today. Is how do we change that. Our own internal anger that we create in law enforcement amongst ourselves, right, and to be smart about those conversations we have with our own personnel, right?
Yeah. Let me jump right in. Look, that's perfect, because one of the problems we have is we base our normative patrol values, whatever else, on outdated information. For instance,
right.
City patrol experiment done in 1974. Is what every municipality bases their time on. Now, they took a study out of Kansas City, which had probably the smallest department, and now every city uses that money.
The Kansas City study.
What dumbass still accepts that? The fact that you should do, should tell you there's a problem, A, with leadership, B, with management, C, with structural change.
Amen.
Because you want to put a frustration. The Kansas City experiment was so far, I argued against it in command school. They thought I was crazy. I almost got kicked out. They were right. But I argued against it based on the fact that this place had no relation to what I did.
But Joe,
right,
that study is still used to define our time.
Today, exactly. Kansas City study. Go ahead, Chief.
Look it up.
Yeah, you cannot use that data. You can take that information and look at it, but you have to individualize that to each agency, right? So you're going to have to figure out what are the values are going to be used to determine those type of things. You know, staffing, the staffing model is the same thing. You know, it's 2 officers per 1,000 people is supposedly what's supposed to work. So that means you got, you know, that's not relative. It doesn't. For us, it may be, let's say, 48 people. Do I necessarily need 48 now? Because I use 44 probably. You know, so, but then you got to change that and go to something that you can quantify from your own internal agency, taking something from Chicago PD, it worked.
But see,
in my organization.
Here's a simple answer to just the one question that I introduced that we got into the deep discussion on. How about this? Since we're solution-oriented here, if you're one of these sergeants with stripes that does nothing but drive around and you don't go to nothing unless an officer calls you and you have to go, how about instead of calling Stan or Joe or anybody else on the radio asking them how long they're going to be over there, why don't you take your happy ass over there and then ask me, is there anything I can do to help you? And find out what I'm doing. You don't have an activity sheet like Stan has where I got to mark down every call I'm going to, when I got there, when I left, how long I was there, and whether I did a report or not. Okay? How about you're a supervisor? Supervise. Don't come when I call you. If you're concerned with why something is taking me so long or another officer's complaining over the MDT because they don't have the courage to say anything to me as to why a call's taking so long, you're a sergeant. You get in that car, drive over there, and don't get out and go, why are you taking so long? Get out and say, hey, is there something I can help you with? You need any help over there?
How about get out and watch? If you have great community policing officers that engage with your community and they are good and they're always the name that pops up and they're always the one that, you know, people are asking for, go watch them. Go watch them. It's not about catching somebody doing something wrong. Go learn from them. Mm-hmm. Pay attention to their nonverbal. Pay attention to their proximity. How close do they stand to people? Do they touch them? Do they not? Pay attention to their tone. Pay attention whenever they start to react and do things differently. Learn from the person who's already doing it well. That is the best way that we get better at it.
And how the people react to them. What you saw was threatening, they're comfortable with. Because that is the norm, the body language, the activity for that specific area. You know, that's what I think is failed so much is I think in the profession, we look at what scares us individually, and we don't go into that situation and look at how this officer, whether they're black, white, male, or female, they're totally comfortable with it. You didn't see this? Well, no. Well, they could have had a gun.
Yeah.
We live in scenario world. They could have had a gun. They could have swung from the rafters with a knife and cut your head off. That's bullshit. What is? Let's just deal with what is for a minute. Go ahead, Chief.
I
was going to say that, Dave, you got to go back to the cultural issue. I mean, because even back when I was at a former agency, you know, we did a 50-point evaluation system. I consistently got 49s. And the one point that I never received is because I was never in the office as a lieutenant, which didn't make much sense to me because, as you were saying, and the agency I came from was a lot busier than we're at now, but there were 20 calls holding. Somebody had to go answer those calls, right? So I'm not knocking my boss in any way, shape, or form because he's a great mentor, but it was that old organizational, that's the way this is going to be as a leader, a supervisor, you're to supervise. Well, I feel that I had the ability to supervise by being on the street, right? And they're an officer on this panel right here that won't tell you that those supervisors are usually the best supervisors, the ones that are out there answering the call and go to the call. Don't show up and go, well, you know, you need anything. I'm a sergeant. You know, I got these stripes right here. You know, if you blah, blah, blah. You just stand there. You need anything? No. Even a drive-by, right? I just drive-by. Go on the call. The officer stand up talking to somebody. Roll the window down. All good?
Hey, Chief, two of the best mentors I had were both female commanders or lieutenants in most departments, both white, Claire and Mary Crook. They would come to my scene, whether it was a murder, a burglary, whatever it was. When they came, my responsibility was to brief them on what I had and who all was doing what. Their next words out of their mouth would be,
"What do you need?
Do you need me to take a statement?" That's the hardest thing to get a supervisor above to do with some officers is to take a statement.
Well,
they would go take a statement or anything I needed.
Organizationally, in law enforcement, that's part of that shift. Right? We need to get, you know, a Dr. Cruz to come in and talk about how we deal with people, right? And that's, you know, and I say deal with people. We are somewhat pretty good at someone. This is going to freak out. I think we do a good job at dealing with the public as a whole. internally, we are horrible. We are absolutely horrible within organizations on how we deal with our own people.
Yep.
Right? So we can go out, we can go, you know, deal with a problematic issue that occurs time and time again, and navigate our way through that. No real, you know, we find a root cause, but we provide a solution to this person. But internally, we suck because of the paramilitary organizational culture that
That's
we have with
right.
these agencies, and that creates issues. So when we hold on to that idea and don't let individuals be individuals, right, under the policy, under the guidelines that we have set forth within an organization, then we're failing. And so if we can't do it internally, how do we expect people to do it at their best externally? So we create these issues. So it's got to start from within, right, and provide as we move up the ladder of promotion, then it's providing service to the people that are under us and then training them, again, not necessarily about anger in America, but then training them to take our positions as we leave.
All right, we're at the four-minute mark, so let's get the final input. Claire, you've been so quiet up there. Come on.
Hey, I just think it was a good show. I think it brought a lot of knowledge to the viewers, which is awesome. I think this week we hit on a lot of learning, which I felt like I was back in psychology class, psychology 101, so that was good. But all that stuff needs to be taught in academies, and I'm sure that Izzy will touch on that too, but like we've all said, that academies need to be longer and officers need to be taught more. So that's all I have to say about that. So.
All right.
Good show.
Dr. Cruz?
I'll just kind of add to on the anger side of things. It's something we all feel, and it's common to all of us. We have to stop making excuses for it. We have to learn how to take personal responsibility and then also take responsibility in our environment, and that's going to come through direct communication, and it takes a lot of practice. So might as well start today.
All right. Izzy?
Great show. Glad to be here. A couple things, points that I'll make. I think that on the whole, policing needs to really do a better job of updating things. I mean, what you're talking about with the Kansas City report from 1976, that's from 1976. I'm technically not supposed to publish, when I'm sourcing an article, I am not supposed to publish an article or a report or study that's more than 2 to 3 years old. But you got cops following reports from 1974. And that's happening across the board. You know, like the methods and practices pulling people over, the little things like lane changing and stuff that we use to pull people over, that has been identified as being created by a chief of police in Florida who was basing it off of racially biased practices of airport enforcement during a time when there were bombings. It's been proven to completely be designed to target people of color. Around the country, we're still using it.
Mm-hmm.
The study, quote unquote, that proves that you guys know about this one, that it's like, what is it, 20 feet before someone can, like, it's a 20 foot distance of someone with a knife that can get to you in a certain amount of time.
Yeah, reactionary.
That's not a scientific study. That was a cop in his backyard with a watch. Okay, and people across the board use that as justification for shooting people. That's insane.
It must be really cold. Froze the Wi-Fi.
Yeah, that's it. Final thoughts.
Yeah, very good show. A lot of good topics that came out about this, and I hope people got a little bit of.
They don't want less police. They want better police. When they say they want more police, they say they want more. They want to see police responding more to things other than stuff that we see them responding for. So it's just narrative controls. And as a negative person, I will also push back and just kind of annoy me. They seem very difficult. They don't like to have tough conversations about facts and figures that make them upset. And I think there's too much of that going around. We need to start facing these facts because too many people want to talk to me about a true crime story, about a serial killer that raped and murdered 50 women. But then I want to have a conversation about police sexual misconduct. And they're like, yo, you're so negative. You're bringing everybody down. What the hell is that about?
Dude, That's why I love you. You're like that tea bag with a leak in it. You know, the tea's still good, but you taste the leaves. And hey, it all goes down, bro. I love that. That was good. Chief?
Yeah. Why are you so angry, is he? Dang, man.
My man.
Good topic. You know, I hope people got a lot of got good information from Dr. Cruz. That's important stuff about the way that anger functions. I think once you can digest that and understand how that works, then you can begin to work on your own anger, and that becomes very important because for me personally, when I learned about it and I realized it, I was able to deal with things from a different perspective versus, you know, where I had always been. So, you know, it's a training process and very good, very important information. And I do agree academies need to be longer. I've been teaching in law enforcement for more than 20 years, and it's just not enough. There's too much stuff that we need to get our officers to understand about this profession, the impacts that you have both internal and external, and we need to find the time to do it.
All right, Big Joe.
Well, just to emphasize, we need to talk to kids, not at them, and that applies. That's very applicable to what we do to the citizens. You talk to them, not at them, and you find that this de-escalation will come into play almost naturally.
All right, Big John, final thoughts, and if you would, John, can you remind everybody about the special thing with the program? But your final thoughts, bro.
Yes, real quickly, we're having not so much a competition, but we're reaching out to our listeners and asking for you guys to choose a topic. Whichever topic receives the most likes, Stan will post it on his Facebook page, and we will have you up here next week as a host of the show. My final thoughts is this, that there's so much anger, and if I'm talking to families, couples, allow your spouse to leave out the door to cool off. Stop blocking the door, say, you want to talk to me now. When someone's angry, they cannot talk to you. And stop growing more anger because that person wants to leave. Give them the opportunity to cool off. Then come back and have a meaningful discussion, because two angry people can't have a meaningful discussion. And maybe that eliminate some of this domestic violence. And I just want to do this is my last thing, Stan. I remember watching Eddie Murphy in the theater, and everyone cracked up off of his joke. And he was talking about the mother beating the son. And he said, as he was crying, he was like, please, God, kill her, right? And everybody in the theater cracked up because a lot of kids had that thought before. A lot of kids have gotten so angry at their parents for whipping them that they wanted something bad. Society today, people still wish bad on someone else because they're mad at them. They're angry at them. I wish he crashed. I wish if this happened to him. I hope he loses his job. What makes people so damn angry to wish harm on someone else? And on that note, I want to say that's it. And one last thing, real quick. Dr. Corsi, you're going to have to one day write about the anger that's accompanied with tears, that someone gets so angry that they literally cry because of the pain and hurt and not being able to respond the way they want to. Please one day write about that. Thank you. I'm done.
And that would be a good one. With that, we appreciate everybody over here, and we're going to get out. Thanks, you guys, for being here today. Everybody be safe and have a good rest of your day.
Behind the Blue Curtain, Saturdays at 11 a.m. Eastern. Discretion is advised.